We're ready now for the argument in the matter of Aquedot's products liability litigation. Mr. Barno.
May it please the Court. My name is Ben Barno, and I'm here today on behalf of the plaintiff's appellants in this case. It is plaintiff's position that the district court's order was improper and that this can be reviewed both as de novo and abuse of discretion.
Poor Judge Kaur.
Well, I'm not sure he's poor. His day today?
Yeah.
Well, it shows he was an active and busy jurist.
Yeah.
And criticism makes us all stronger, I suppose. As long as it doesn't kill us, I think Nietzsche said that. But in any event, with regard to this opinion, what happened is that the court, on a motion for class certification, as the court here is...
We know what happened.
Thank you.
The question is, what are the consequences of what happened? And here's my problem with your argument. I'm perfectly willing to accept the proposition that a district judge can't say, well, I disagree with the rule, so I'm going to do something that I think is better. I mean, that's not the way the rules work. But what the district judge said here fundamentally is that class certification would make the class worse off since they can already get a refund. There's no reason why they should have a refund, less transactions costs, less attorney's fees, less the cost of notice. And it looks to me like there's a clause in the rule that covers this very subject, and that's Rule 23A4, which says that no class can be certified unless the representative parties will fairly and adequately protect the interests of the class. That's what seems to me what the district judge concluded, that class certification here would not fairly and adequately protect the interests of the class. Indeed, it would make the class members worse off, and representatives who propose to make the class members worse off aren't adequately protecting them. Now, why isn't that squarely within the text of the rule?
It's not, Your Honor, as I see it, because the linchpin for that finding is based upon facts that did not exist in this record. And, for instance, the suggestion that there were cash refunds or a cash refund program that was publicized is absolutely incorrect. It was not.
I understand that you disagree with Judge Kaur on that point. You know, he maintained, of course, that the availability of refunds was widely known. But if you would tell me what specific evidence in the record will, in your view, show us that he was wrong, because I gather that as many as 500,000 customers did obtain refunds. Surely just that fact alone would lend credence to the notion that consumers were indeed aware that they had, the possibility of asking for a refund.
Let me respond to that. First of all, there's 740,571 products that have not been refunded, and that's... Let me turn to the record, if I could, because the comment was that it was supported on the record, which it is not. And dealing with the issue of refunds, somehow we metamorphosize that into the supposition that's necessarily cash refunds, which the testimony is in the record. There's nothing in the record that shows they were indeed cash refunds. Some were credits, some were amounts for less than the consumer actually paid, and some forced people to go back to the various companies that, in our eyes, sold a bad product. But let's turn to...
Counsel, I would appreciate it if you would address my question. Right? That is why you may think that your clients are protecting the interests of the class. But as you frame the issue on appeal, it's whether the district judge can just chuck the language of the rule out the window and go his own way. And I ask the question how that issue is presented given Rule 23A4. Now, what you answered is, and also said in response to Judge Rovner, is, well, the district judge's findings weren't supported by the record. But that doesn't address my question at all.
They still represent the interests of the class because the rights that the class members have not been addressed even by this self-imposed out-of-court program by people that cannot be fair because they're not impartial. So that Rule 4, in my view, would not become applicable. The idea that the judge has that lawyers' fees would be taken out of this recovery is absolutely incorrect. Because we have fee-shifting statutes, there are also other matters that the class should proceed on, and I think has proceeded, that would be injunctive relief and punitive damages. Now, Judge Kaur found that punitive damages doesn't matter much. We cited cases to show that you could certainly get multiples on that. Ironically, Spin Master is suing Bureau of Veritas for punitive damages for this very same product for what they allege is grossly negligent conduct. CD 436, Exhibit 14, regarding the idea of this refund program, which was not publicized, there isn't one notice that talked about it. Here's the chief operating officer, Spin Master. Our offer is replacement beads or a product.
Can I try once more? You have briefed this case on the assumption that it presents the question to us whether district judges are entitled to disregard the language of the rule. And you contend that if they're not entitled to disregard the language of the rule, you win. But what you're saying now sounds like this appeal doesn't present any issue about whether district judges can disregard the language of the rule. The issue is only whether the district court prudently decided that the class members would be made worse off by class certification. Am I correctly understanding what you're now arguing?
No, I'm not being clear, and I apologize, Your Honor. What I'm saying is we do believe that the textual approach, as he calls it, is one that should be followed, and I think that...
And then that leads to my question, why Rule 23A4 is not the text that authorizes the district judge to do exactly what he did, assuming he's right about whether the class will be made worse off by class certification. Now, is there any reason in your view why Rule 23A4 is an insufficient grant of authority to the district judge to do what he did if he's right in his beliefs about the real interests of the class members?
Because I still think it needs an adjudicatory process.
Well, why can't the term adjudicating reasonably be understood to mean resolving, whether one resolves the controversy in court or out of court? You've argued that the language of Rule 23B3 doesn't permit a court to consider out-of-court means of resolving a dispute, and I really have a lot of problems with that.
Well, I think the Murray case, the decision of this court, Murray supports that proposition, as I think all does Henson in terms of the literal interpretation. And I think that the adjudicatory process lends a review that is not otherwise available to the out-of-court process. But I do think our argument is double-pronged in that not only do we think that it should not have occurred in view of the textual approach, but even if we switch to what Judge Kaur called a policy approach, he fails because his findings do not comport with the record, which is why, I read a couple of the items. For instance, I think fair and efficient for the alternative adjudicatory process, assuming you want to call this that, still requires fair. And you can't have it fair if it's not impartial. For instance, we have Anton Raby's CD 499, tab L7, president and CEO saying, I need to get us to have another weekend bought so we get weekend sales, delay for more info. That is not an impartial person. The program that he administers cannot be fair. In terms of consumers not being able to get what they want, the record shows that some people only got a partial amount. The record does not show whether or not it was, which part was cash, which part was a credit, for instance, and which part was a chit. So whether if we accept the idea that you can't have an out-of-court program, it still has to be fair as well as efficient. And the lack of impartiality of these people do not make it fair. What also makes it unfair is they talk in terms of their widely publicized recall and they switch to refund. There was no refund publicized. First of all, there's no evidence in the record that it was widely publicized. But assuming that it was widely publicized, it does not work in the interest of the defendants, but rather works against them. Why? Because it doesn't tell the entire truth of the matter. It limits what people can get, and nowhere in it does it say you can get a cash refund. So the reality is they defeat their own program even under the policy approach. If this defendant wants to give cash refund, no better way than to have a certification, or at least get their notices, which a class certification will do. And a class certification notice will be approved by a court, which again points out why the adjudicatory process is better. And it will have the whole truth of the matter, not saying call Spin Master. And by the way, I point out that, again, none of the notices ever talked about a cash refund. At class cert, counsel for a defendant said, come on down and get your refund. Come on down where? Saskatchewan? Where? And the other item is that the call numbers.
I think Saskatchewan's up.
Well, if you're not at the North Pole, where Santa Claus would have to be to believe their refund program, but in any event, the hours that they have were business hours, call Monday through Friday.
Santa Claus is actually in Indiana.
I never mailed a letter there, Your Honor.
Santa
I'm going to
Claus
keep that
Indiana.
In mind. Thank you. He must move around, those reindeers. But the call number was on the CPSC, which is in the record, was 9 to 6 Eastern time on weekdays for a product that was capable of putting children into a comatose state where Spin Master itself sues the supplier for gross negligence and seeks punitive damages. I ask you, why can't the class seek punitive damages? They can't. They tell you they did everything, this and that. Well, let's see that in terms of a judgment. This case, even under the policy decision, where if the court could do that, his record, his view of the record is incorrect. In fact, at the class cert hearing, the counsel that argued it on behalf of plaintiffs stated to the district court that there was, quote, no refund program. That's a CD 503 at 55:15-19. The district court noted, quote, that's a fair comment, close quote. You don't see that's a fair comment regarding the refund program, which didn't exist. People weren't told about it. Tell them about it if you're genuine. And if you're not genuine, don't come to a court and say, hey, we had a refund program. Come on down. Come on down to the lawyer's office. They have $14 million worth of monies that they're holding. That's what this is about. They don't want to give it back. They tell you they do. Class certification will make them give it back. The idea that somehow lawyers are overextending themselves here, I think, is not accurate.
Question about Rule 23B3-4. Another one of the things the district court has to consider under that subdivision is the likely difficulty in managing a class action. Would this class action be manageable given the fact that nobody knows the names and addresses of the vast majority of purchasers?
Absolutely.
How do you give notice?
Well, you give notice through publication. Your Honor, I could point to numerous
when
cases.
Notice is given through publication, what percentage of people responds?
Respond depends on obviously on the type of the case. These percentages can be lower than the 50% here that came in, no question about it. But the reality is, I think, what is the percentage of the 740,571,000 product purchasers? And, of course, it depends on the quality of the notice. If you give, for instance, if you have a judgment, and we dealt with this with Judge Monson in Microsoft civil antitrust litigation, where the issue was, what happens if we have a judgment here? What do you do with the money? Assume Microsoft doesn't settle. And as I'm sure this panel is well aware, telling something the panel knows, at the end of the day, when you get the fund, you still have to have a claim process to get that money. But then the issue becomes, what happens when people don't claim it? Well, it's a class action, has a deterrent value. Some of the law says you give it, you teach to the state, or people that do file a claim get more. But the idea that you can't ultimately get a complete refund of the money that these defendants shouldn't have is not true. Whether or not...
Completely wandering away from my question. My question doesn't have anything to do with the propriety of Cypre remedies. It had to do with the difficulty in managing a class action. Management includes individual notice, and it includes an individual right to make claims. Now, how are those things going to be possible?
They're going to be as possible as they were in my AOL online litigation where anybody who thought they had a claim sent a claim in. It'll be a claim process with a published notice. I would expect the cost, publication cost to be substantial. Class counsel will do fair notice with a quality firm such as Hillsoft Notifications, Kinsella, Rust, et cetera. Every consumer class action is confronted with the problem of giving constitutional notice. Current findings, I believe, requirements are you should have a reach of 80% or over, and we will accomplish that. I believe this case will is a strong possibility of going to judgment. If I recognize anything to date, all cases are subject to settlement. And the largesse, the $14 million that they are improperly retaining, will eventually go in accordance with society's requirements. Thank you. Slow on the cleanup, I apologize.
Mr. Rothstein.
Hey, please the court. Yes.
Mr. Rothstein, let's talk about the recall program.
Okay.
Tell me how consumers are advised that refunds are available to them. Are they told of that option when they call the toll-free number or when they log onto the website? Or do they only learn of that option from the retailers themselves, or if they ask Spin Master directly for a refund?
It's a multi-step process because they receive notice of the recall and they are advised to bring their product back or to call a number in order to obtain a remedy. When they arrive at the retailer takes the product, and it's the normal situation when you bring a product back to a retailer that they give you a refund. And in this case, the policy of the retailers was to offer a refund. And in the case of Spin Master, if you were to call the number and you ask for a remedy, the preferred remedy by Spin Master was to give a replacement product or another product of equal value. However, if asked, they would provide a refund, and that is very clear in the record. And what Judge Kaur did find, and I think he was correct in finding, is that because you had of a possible 1.3 million people who purchased this product, 513,000 of them obtained a refund, that it was widely known. It was
you've given me a very nice answer, but here's what I want to know. If consumers aren't affirmatively told up front that a refund is among their choices, and I didn't hear that in your response.
Consumers,
are they affirmatively told up front that a refund is available?
No, we are very clear in our briefing.
You didn't say that no very loudly.
We were very clear in our briefing that the word refund was not contained in the recall notice.
Right.
Okay.
So would I think it was worth my time and effort if I thought my only options were a replacement or a coupon? I'm just wondering.
Well, I think you've got to take the facts as they exist. You've got the group of people who purchased this product. They were advised to bring the product back, and well over 600,000 of them did, and 513,000 of them obtained a refund. And I think that Judge Kaur's findings, which are subject to a clear error standard of review, was very clearly that based on the evidence as he saw it, it was very clear to consumers that a refund was available.
What were the purchasers told would happen when they returned the product to the point of purchase? I mean, I assume that that's how this went. That's how
Right.
recalls typically are. Return the product to the point of purchase, and then what?
And then
what
obtain
were
a remedy.
And that's what the notice said?
The notice said return it for a replacement product, or they could swap out the beads for the correct beads.
Okay. So they were told to return the product to the point of purchase for an exchange, essentially.
That's right.
One of two forms of exchange. But if they did that and asked for a refund instead of an exchange, they were given their money back.
Well, it would work like this. The distributor, which was Spin Master, it recalled the product with the CPSC. And in recalling the product, Spin Master created the recall notice that was posted on their website, that was posted on the CPSC's website, and received a lot of press. And then you've got the retailers, and the retailers have policies. And when you bring the product back to the retailer, it's the retailer's policy to issue a refund. So because Spin Master issued the recall, they crafted the language of the recall notice. But in this instance, because you've got retailers who actually sell the product, and as we all know, it's more efficient if you purchase a product at a particular retailer, like Walmart or Toys R Us or Target, that you bring the product back to that retailer. Then you're operating with the within the parameters of the retailer's policies. And when you bring it back to the retailer, it's not a matter of saying, well, I was only offered this particular remedy, can I get a different one? You're then operating within the parameters of the retailer's policies, and for that reason, we think that Judge Kaur was absolutely correct in finding that it was well known and widely known of the availability of the refund and of the refund program. So with that, I think that the district court did very correctly consider the facts as they were found in this case and found that the plaintiff's characterizations of this program as being hit and miss, secret, half secret, only available to the lucky and resourceful, were just bald allegations, and they had no discernible basis. Because, as I said, hundreds of thousands, 513,000 people to be exact, came to the retailers and to Spin Master and obtained a refund. And given the availability of a refund, our judge correctly found that there's no need here for all of the transaction costs associated with a class action lawsuit, the lawyer's fees, judicial intervention, delay, because there's no realistic possibility in this case that they're going to be any better off. And I think that was the fundamental underpinning of our judge's decision. Now, our judge did make his decision under Rule 23b-3, and we think that his decision is fully supportable under Rule 23b-3. We also would note, because in listening to the questioning put to the appellant, that we think it is also supportable under Rule 23a-4, but
you didn't make that argument, though.
We didn't
make an adequacy argument.
So you can't make it now.
Well, I think that we were addressing the appeal that was brought to us, and we think it is fully supportable under Rule 23b-3. And for that reason, we think that the interpretation of and
well,
the correct
that's an atextual reading of the rule. You would have to concede that, right?
I don't. I don't think it's an atextual reading because the word is adjudication. And we're talking about...
Well, a recall is not an adjudication.
Well, we believe it is because it's a process of...
It's a form of private, non-adjudicatory dispute resolution.
Yeah.
But you don't want to have double talk, right? It's Orwellian to say that both adjudication and not adjudication count as adjudication.
Well, the way I read 23...
Actually, you know, people are going to go around saying war is peace.
Well, I don't read it that way because I think if you look at the rule and you look at the context of the rule and you look at the word adjudicating in the context of the rule, that it is very well supported.
But in what way does something like a recall program, which lacks any type of independent arbitrator or mediator, be characterized as adjudication?
Well, the first point is that I don't think the word adjudication requires an independent arbitrator or mediator.
Well, what does it require since it doesn't require a court and it doesn't require a mediator and it doesn't require an adjudicator?
It requires
a tea kettle. What does it require?
It requires a fair and efficient method of resolving the controversy.
Where is that? When, you know, Where is that here? Where is that?
Where is that in this case? Well, we've got a situation where there is a recall put in place. It is done with a government agency. It is crafted to conform to the government agency's requirements and rules. And in doing so, the adjudication involves this process of dealing with the government, coming up with the correct remedy, and then executing on the correct remedy. And I'll then go back to the findings of Judge Kaur, because
who's the neutral overseer or decision maker who will determine what an individual plaintiff is owed?
Well, I don't think that the term adjudicating requires there be a neutral mediator or overseer.
You've just
that's Orwellian, all right.
The law of the world in one sentence.
Well, I don't think so. If the word was litigation, then I would agree with you, but I think the word is adjudicating, and I think that the word adjudicating, when read in context with the terms methods for fairly and efficiently, it...
What's fair and efficient here?
What's fair and efficient is that we've got a process in which consumers are asked to bring their product back for a remedy, and that they be provided with that remedy without the unnecessary invocation of
a court mediator or arbitrator.
That's a form of loss compensation, but it's not an adjudicatory method, or at least a recognizable adjudicatory method. If the rule said that it has, you know, a class action is superior to all other available methods of loss compensation, you might have a point. But
well, I think that if the rule were to say for fairly and efficiently litigating the controversy, then I think that that would be correct. But the term here is adjudicating, and I think that adjudicating can mean a form of settlement or dispute resolution. And I think that you do fully accomplish that in this context when people bring their product back. But I would like to point out one other thing, which is that the choice here is really between the process of having a class action litigation as compared to really probably just a couple of lawsuits, because you don't have a class that really is interested in the type of remedy that the class action is trying to accomplish, because what's going on here is that the remedy is already available. Judge Kaur found that he doesn't believe a court could fashion a remedy in this case that is any better than the remedy that has been made available to consumers. Therefore, what you've got are a lot of transaction costs to get right back to the same thing. So with that, I would like to deal with standing in this case, because I think standing really is a threshold issue, and I think it's an important issue in this case, because I think that this case falls squarely within the type of no injury product liability line of cases where courts repeatedly...
I don't even comprehend your argument. I mean, I certainly understand the proposition that people who weren't injured don't have standing. But if you think you are buying a product with set of attributes A, B, and C, and you in fact are buying a product with markedly inferior attributes, you're paying too much.
Right, but
people who pay too much for their products are injured. That's the normal stuff of antitrust litigation. All the plaintiffs in an antitrust suit would have bought the product anyway, and in fact, more of them would have bought more of the product had its price been lower. But their claim is they paid too much. Now, why isn't that perfectly sufficient for standing?
Because the situation here isn't one where the product was an inferior product. The situation
was an inferior product. It's contaminated.
Well,
right?
Yeah, you've admitted it. What do you mean it wasn't?
It had a defect.
Why was it recalled?
Well, it had a defect, but for the purpose for which it was sold, it was perfectly acceptable.
For children to play with and swallow?
It was not sold for children to swallow.
Well,
it's if you were representing an auto company and there were a crashworthiness problem in the car, would you be saying, oh, no, it was a perfectly fine car suitable for the purpose for which it was sold, that is, driving in a straight line with nobody getting in the way. It was only a problem when somebody ran into it.
No, but this
one of the things that can happen with products is that kids can swallow them.
But that's true of any product. Any product
no,
a child
it's
can put.
No,
this,
not a great big teddy bear.
Kids may eat little pieces of teddy bear. Right? But one of the hazards for which people plan when they make products is swallowing, and that is why your client specified a covering that was safe when swallowed. But unfortunately, the product had a covering that was unsafe when swallowed.
Well,
you're not helping your cause by making an absurd argument.
But there was never any advertising that this...
Okay, Judge Easterbrook.
But there was no advertising that this product was intended to be eaten. There were specific warnings saying...
You're
choking
not
hazard,
helping
do not.
Your cause by making an absurd argument.
When
a judge tells you your argument is absurd...
And a second judge agrees...
Move along.
And what I'd like to finish with is the fact that we don't think there's any...
I think you have finished. You managed to consume all of your time making the absurd argument. Thank you very much. This case is taken under advisement.